I'm deeply honored to be delivering the first set of lectures in the memory of the illustrious Wang Ruwei, and I'm most grateful to the Academy of Chinese Learning of the University of Tsinghua for the invitation. I would especially like to thank Professor Li Buyong and Liu Dong for their part in this invitation, and to Professor Li Buyong for his kind words. I would also like to thank Guan Xiaolong, who is here, for her translation of the shortened lectures, and to Wang Hui for all her help so far. This is the 8th visit of my wife, Sarah Harrison, and myself to your great country since 1995. And it has been wonderful to watch this country grow and develop. In these lectures, this first is an introductory lecture, and in the following lectures, which I hope that most of you will be able to come to, I will be covering many, many different themes. This lecture is What is the Question? And War, Trade and Empire. Then I will look at modern technology, the origins of capitalism, material wealth and population, universities and science. Then in the fourth lecture, caste and class, games, sports and clubs and hobbies. In the fifth, kinship, marriage and friendship, and associations, trusts and clubs. In the sixth, power and bureaucracy, law and violence. Then in the second to last, education and language and myths of unity. And in the last, religion and ethics, and my answer to the questions I'm raising, and the contradictions of modernity. Can you hear me when I'm just speaking like this, at the back?
Yes.
Good. So that is the very broad range of topics. In fact, I hope I'm covering everything. If I have missed anything, apart from gender, which I noticed I have not talked about specifically, then let me know. I shall speak for about 35 minutes in each lecture, and then give you a little rest for 5 minutes, and then speak another 30 minutes. And then there will be comments for and questions from you if you would like at the end of 20 minutes. If you'd like to explore any of the things that I talk about, or meet myself and my wife, please do come up at the end of the... Is that this thing?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's a rattling sound. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I better hold it. Right. If any of you would like to come and meet me and talk and go off and have some coffee or tea and chat about anything I say in the lectures, I would be very happy to do that, because I would like to meet some of you and to learn about your life and to answer questions and discuss with you. So at the end of any of the lectures, this is a custom in my University of Cambridge, if you want to talk to the lecturer, you go up to them after the lecture and say hello, give me your email address, or send me an email, and then we can meet and talk, walk around your campus and discuss. Okay, I'm here for 1 month and I would be happy to talk to any of you. My email address, in case any of you would like it, is A That's A for Allah. So A, the letter A, I'll write it up. A, M, 12, at CAM, for Cambridge, AC, for academic, UK. AM12@cam.ac.uk. Just send me an email and say, I was interested in what you said about this, or I disagree with what you said about that. Can we meet and talk about it? Okay? And then I'll get in touch. Hello, you can't hear?
Lowercase.
It doesn't matter. It's not case sensitive. I've written it in large case, but actually, if you write it in AM12 in smaller, it's fine too. Okay? The lectures that I'm giving will only give a very short flavour of what I want to say. It's just a quarter of what I am going to produce in a book. So if you don't have a chance to come to all the lectures, or you want to read the full account, we are hoping to publish this set of lectures with Peking University Press in Chinese in the near future. So you will be able to read it as well if you find it interesting. And I'm just giving you a tiny little bit. This is only a quarter of what will be in the book. I realize that many of you will find English difficult to understand, and also that you don't know necessarily very much about my country and what I am going to talk about. So I will speak quite slowly. Is this about the right speed for you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Too fast? Too slow? Okay. I shall read out a paragraph of my talk, which Xiaolong has translated. I hope you all have with you a copy of the Chinese translation. Is there anyone who cannot see the Chinese translation? Anyone not got it? There are a few there. If you could possibly find, there's some copies here. If you could pass those back. And if you could join someone who has got a copy, if you haven't got access, because it's important for you to be able to see it. I think at the end, if you could give us your email addresses, and then we will send you the next one, so you can have it in advance. We will bring some copies as well. Is that right? What I will do is read out the paragraph, which you will have in the Chinese translation. If you can understand my English, you don't need to look at the translation, but you can if you want to. And then I will just sometimes talk a little bit to illustrate what is in the paragraphs, just to make it a little more lively than me just reading out a lecture. And then I will go back to the text. In order to go on this journey together, I need to know who my companions are. That is you. So I would like to ask you just one or two questions about yourselves. The first is, how many of you are scientists? That is, physicists, chemists, mathematicians. If you are a scientist, could you put your hand up? No scientists, or no scientists who can understand English. I was told there were going to be lots of physicists at this talk, so I'm interested to hear that there you are all not scientists. So that means you are all arts, humanities, social sciences. Is that right?
Yes.
No? Who is something else? Okay. How many of you have been to what is still called, I think, the West, in other words, America or Europe. Could you put your hand up if you have been to America or Europe or UK? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Because it may be easier for those of you who have seen the West to understand my lectures. How many of you have been to the UK, to England? 1, 2, 3, I know, at the back. How many of you have been able to understand most of what I've said so far? Please put your hands up. No, that's very good. Most of you can understand, and some of you perhaps were asleep by now already, so most of you can understand. So let us start out on the journey. This is the first paragraph of the translation which you have in front of you. What is the question? If you don't ask the right question, you will get a bad answer. There is a famous historian called Lefebvre who said, "Une question mal posée," or the article was called "Une question mal posée," which is French for a badly asked question. So, the answer, I'm now reading from your text, the answer to large questions depends on how the question is posed or put. This particularly applies to the large questions of the nature, origins, and future of modernity, which is the theme of these lectures. That is what I want to talk about. What is the modern world? And how did it come about? I'll move on to the next bit of the translation. It is rather tempting, with hindsight, to believe that since the great event, and by the great event I mean the development of modern industrial, urban, and scientific societies, has happened. We know, we can see around us, it's happened. We believe that it was bound to happen. And indeed, since much of it has now spread all over the world, perhaps it was not such a difficult thing after all. So we tend to think in what is called a teleological way. We tend to think things are aiming towards some direction. So we were bound to become modern. And part of what I want to establish in my lectures is how very difficult it was to make a modern world. And that is why I've called it the invention of the modern world. It had to be invented. And the chances of it being invented, if you had looked, say, from the Roman Empire or from the Song Dynasty in China, the chances of the modern world as we know it coming about were tiny, in fact, impossible. It is an impossible event. And yet, it has happened. In the next paragraph, when England was the only country in the world to have made the escape from an agricultural world, agrarian constraints, and remained the only one to be able to do this, to escape, for two generations, everyone agreed that it was a miracle. And they all wondered how it had happened and how it could be copied. It was then believed to be an English miracle. Now, there is a timeline along here, 1700, 1800, 1900, and where we are now, 2000. England became a modern industrial, urban, scientific culture. Very early, you could see the beginnings of it around here, about 1750. So, If you use a famous idea from a sociologist, an economist called Rostow, he thought of modernity as like an airport with airplanes going along and then taking off like this. The first takeoff, the first aeroplane to take off into the modern world was in England. That's the first aeroplane. That's from about 1750. And there was nowhere else in the world. Not Holland, not France, not Germany, nowhere. So everyone thought, when they came from France or Holland or Germany, they thought, this is an English miracle. Nowhere else has done it. How has it happened? So, in Tocqueville's day, that is in the early 19th century, and I'm going on to the next paragraph, the question seemed quite obvious. Something new was at work in the world. A new world was emerging. It was not just based on industrial production, on the Industrial Revolution. Nor was it just based on a new understanding of natural laws through science, but above all, by a new social, political, and ideological structure, seen dramatically in America when Tocqueville visited America in the 1830s, but beginning to take the world in a new direction. And yet it seemed so strange and so miraculous that the chance of it spreading from this tiny island here, the first revolution occurred here, and for right up to here, when it began to be copied, this was the only place it was occurring. Tocqueville saw elements of it here, but it wasn't an industrial society. It was still an agricultural society. Yet, amazingly, the elements of this new world began to spread. This began in about 1830. There was a whole two generations before it began to spread. It spread to Belgium, Germany, and France from about 1830. And so people stopped talking about it as an English miracle, and they began to talk about it as a West European miracle, because this was now spreading out. So you had this whole area by the 1840s, 50s, this whole area was beginning to look modern in the sense of industrial and urban. I'll continue to read that paragraph. Yet it still seems so unusual that it was now a European miracle. Even within Europe, it was clearly not easy to have this development. And much of Max Weber's original inspiration, for example, came out of an attempt to understand why parts of Germany, particularly in the Protestant north of Germany, were engaged in this miracle, whereas in the south of Germany, in the Catholic part, they weren't. This is what gave rise to his famous work on the Protestant ethic. And then, I'll read the next paragraph. A generation later, in the 1860s, at the other end of the world, in Japan here, Fukuzawa Yukichi saw the same thing. All of Asia was still an ancient or ancien. I'm using the word from the French, which slightly means something different from ancient. It's used by Tocqueville, ancien régime, which means the old way. It doesn't mean long ago, it means old and pre-modern. All of it, Asia was still ancien, but the West, and this now included France, Germany, as I mentioned, were becoming modern. And In the period 1870 to 1910, Japan joined modernity in this sense, largely by adopting many parts of the recipe which had worked in Europe and was exactly in that period working in North America. So one Asiatic society had strangely hopped over to here. So by 1900, this was a modern industrial society, and just this part of the world. So here you have, from about here, you have Japan and also America, North America, has joined from about the 1870s. So by that time, it looks like a European, American, Japanese miracle. And this miracle, this kind of modernity, is crashing into all the other cultures of the world. What was causing it? Many people tried to investigate. And I'm reading here again. The search was on for certain features in the West which made the rise of modernity occur. Those who saw it as inevitable each chose their own favorite causes or cards. Christianity doesn't work for Japan. Water communication, feudalism, minerals from America, coal supplies, each of them possibly causing this change. What is amazing is that apart from one other major breakthrough here, which is the Soviet Union, from about 1920, there is no further development into modern urban industrial growth until after the Second World War, till about here, 1950s. And at that point in the 1950s, there was a sudden breakthrough of what were then known as the Four Little Tigers. Have you heard of the Four Little Tigers?
Yeah.
So you know where they are. What is interesting about them is, and this was the explanation put forward, is that two of them were British, Singapore and Hong Kong, and two were Japanese, influenced heavily, Taiwan, South Korea. So it was thought there were little places which could be pulled up by some bigger industrial nation. And so it remained until only 30 years ago, the late 1980s, Deng Xiaoping and the rise of the rest of the world, more or less, mainly China, India, and Brazil and South America. And so what had started as a miracle here was now spreading all over the world. And of course, Australia had long had been so, and Canada. This leaves, at the moment, only two major regions untouched, because later Malaysia and Southeast Asia joined. So you have mainly this area and this area. The whole belt of Africa and the Middle East is the one, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that area, is the one last area which hasn't joined this revolution. I now go back to the text. A number of theorists argued that the question had been wrongly posed. The Orient had never been backwards, really. There had been no special Western miracle to be investigated. All Weber's speculations about things which were stopping modernity in the East or encouraging it in the West, religion, a certain legal system, democracy, Western logic, were irrelevant or mistaken. Look, everyone has it. Weber got it wrong. The East could do perfectly well without a special religion or a special legal system, whatever was supposed to have caused it. Basically, the whole project of trying to understand the Western or English or European miracle from Montesquieu up to the 1970s had been a form of Orientalist thinking in science terms, a making of Asia into a backward area. In some ways, Pomerantz, Bin Wong, and the California School, who I'll talk about in the third lecture, or the fourth lecture, were the logical final instance of this revisionism. In his book, how many of you have heard of Pomerantz's book, The Great Divergence? None of you? Oh, well, that's interesting. Anyway, there is a book called The Great Divergence by Ken Pomerantz, which I'll be talking about later. And basically, Pomerantz argues that all of the world was the same until here. England was just the same as the rest. And the divergence, the separation of China and Europe, starts around here. This is his argument. And as a result, we can explain the difference between China and the West by accidental factors, particularly coal, the presence of coal, or the presence of imperial wealth coming in from the European empires. And so now, in world history, many people argue, and this is the last paragraph, for the revisionists, the problem has disappeared. The modern world was never a peculiar thing. In a sense, it was always everywhere. There's always been modernity. In another sense, it was a set of surface changes in economy and technology, which spread very simply and easily across the world. Modernity, to many thinkers now, is a toolkit of inventions, many of them originally made in China, taken to the West, reused, brought back to China and India. I want to now turn to one or two further things to explain the background of these lectures. The first point, and I'll summarize because I need to move a little far faster. The next paragraph says that I am not claiming that the modern world is necessarily better than the ancien regime. I'm just trying to study this objectively as a historian. Secondly, I am arguing that there was nothing inevitable about it. It didn't have to happen, as I've said before. It seems to me to be a giant accident, as I shall explain. Thirdly, it was not, although I say invented, and I shall argue that it was invented here in England, I want to stress that almost everything that was made in England came from outside. Many of the great inventions came from China, many came from India and from the Middle East. They all flowed round and ended up in England. I often think of it like this, like a sand timer. All the inventions and discoveries of the Greeks and of the Chinese and everything flowed down. They came through the gate of England, as I shall explain, and then they flowed out again over all over the world. So the English are not the great inventors in the modern world in one sense, but they put it together, as, for example, they did with football. No doubt, as I've got pictures of the Chinese playing football 1,000 years ago, it was the English who took all the sort of rough games of football around the world and made the rules, made it into a proper game, and then it spread from England. Lastly, I want to tell you something about what I mean by modernity. Many of you will think that what modernity means, and as I've tried to explain it, is something to do with the Industrial Revolution, with technology or modern science. But you can be very scientifically advanced and have big cities, but not be modern. For instance, I don't think that North Korea, I hope there are not many North Koreans in the audience here, but I don't think that North Korea is a modern society. On the other hand, I think that the Dutch in the 17th century or the Italians in the 16th century were modern. By this, what I mean, and this is very important to explain, what I mean is that in anthropology, we divide the world into four areas, institutional areas: economics, religion and ideology, politics, and society. In very simple tribal societies, all this is united. A tribe is a political unit, it's an economic unit, it's a religious unit, it's a social unit. You haven't separated these at all. What happens in history is that as civilizations rise, you begin to separate these into separate institutional spheres. You tend to make it first into you first separate economy and society. Those are still joined together. The unit of production, for example, is the family, the economic unit. So they're joined together, and the political and the religious are usually joined together. And many great civilizations are like that. They've made the first separation of those areas. If you don't follow this, don't worry, it will come out in the lectures, but I'll just give you the idea to begin with. Modernity, Western modernity, and this is where you really need to think about whether China is a modern society or not. Western modernity makes a further separation in which it separates all of these. So politics is politics, but it's nothing to do with ideology or religion. Economics is economics, but it's nothing to do with the family or society. You have four separate institutional fields. So modernity is like a nuclear explosion. It split apart the atom. The atom is tribal worlds where everything is joined. Modernity has split. And the energy and freedom and openness of Western society is based on keeping these apart. We don't allow our religious leaders to tell our politicians what to do. We don't like to allow our families to tell us what to do in our economic life or how to vote. We keep things apart. And this is very unusual, and it is the modern world, as I will explain further. So I will stop there for 3 or 4 minutes and see if just let you have a rest, because it must be quite difficult for you to follow. If you haven't understood everything, it's quite abstract. I'll repeat things through the lectures, so you'll be able to.